Lina Akhmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Get this. Experts say many countries are reporting a surge in cases of gender-based violence due to COVID-19 lockdown measures. Data from the United Nations reveals that one in three women worldwide are experiencing either intimate partner violence or non-partner sexual violence during their lifetime. According to the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, the rates of gender-based violence are significantly high in the eastern and southern African regions for reasons such as alcohol use, overall increased poverty, violence in urban slum areas, and conflict areas. For more on gender-based violence, I spoke with Dr. Kemi Da Silva Ibru, an OBGYN specialist and founder of the Women at Risk International Foundation in Nigeria. Take a listen.
Dr. Kemi Da Silva Ibru, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you very much for having me, Ledford.
You're heading an organization that deals with domestic violence, gender-based violence, and other issues related to that. First and foremost, when we talk about domestic violence, this is a very basic and what may seem like an obvious question, but would you define for us what domestic violence is?
Well, in actual fact, like you rightly said, when we in the gender-based violence space discuss the issues of gender-based violence, there are a lot of different terminology that we use. We reference gender-based violence because it's gender neutral, but it's one of those terminologies that is interchangeable with violence against women. And unapologetically so, because the more vulnerable groups are women and girls. When you're dealing with domestic violence, you're moving into a more intimate partner violence environment, where a lot of times the violence may be in a home scenario and may involve a partner or a husband. At Warif, the focus of the work that we carry out is actually in the sexual violence space. Most of the women and the young girls that we see at the Warif Rape Crisis Center and the target audiences that we go into communities to address and empower are young girls and women that are survivors, typically of rape and sexual violence.
How would you describe the issue of sexual violence and domestic violence in the community where you are, whether it's Nigeria in particular or Africa in general?
Well, I mean, as you're probably aware, Nigeria is the largest country on the African continent. I mean, we have a population of over 200 million people. And half of us are women. So we have an average of 100 million women. And 64% of the population are under the age of 24. When we discuss the issue of gender-based violence, our statistics are such that one in four girls before the age of 18 would have experienced at least one violent sexual encounter. And over 70% would experience more than one. So when you look at the math, what we see is an average of over 10,000 cases every day in Nigeria where a woman or a young girl is enduring a violent sexual encounter.
What are some of the consequences that you are seeing very frequently, whether they're physical or psychological?
Well, the consequences that we see, truth be told, can be split between the direct consequence to the survivor, and then of course the impact on her family and by extension the community. With regards to the consequence to her, we have the immediate health concerns. I mean, a lot of times, as you rightly pointed out, there's an overlap between physical and sexual violence. So many of the young girls and women that we see have been physically attacked, so we're dealing with physical injuries. Then we're dealing with the mental and the emotional injuries that come with these horrific attacks. So you have women dealing with the immediate emotional concerns. She has fear, she has anxiety, she has concerns for her safety. She has the psychological concerns of, you know, inability to sleep. She might have mood swings. She would have a total loss of affect and the things that she would typically enjoy. She may get post-traumatic stress disorder and flashbacks based on perhaps a trigger that reminds her of the event. And then, of course, there are women that are enduring these acts of violence without getting the adequate attention that might start to get suicidal ideation. They might start to think, well, it's not worth living any longer. And so what's the point? So we're dealing with a woman that's dealing with not just the physical impact, she's also dealing with the emotional and the psychological impact of the abuse or the attack. And then from a medical point of view, you're looking at an increase in the number of cases of possibly HIV or other sexually transmitted diseases, because many of these attacks go unprotected when we're dealing with penetrative sexual intercourse. We're also dealing with unwanted pregnancies. We could have an increased number of unwanted pregnancies. And of course, then we're dealing with the long-term medical impact, perhaps, of these attacks, that as it affects a woman's fertility. With regards to her family, as we all know, women are typically the glue in their homes. And so an adverse impact on her adversely impacts on the rest of the family. It might affect her ability to earn, and she's probably an equal member in terms of providing for the home. And then this will trickle out into the community and certainly would affect the social development of many countries, because based on our numbers, we are representative of perhaps at least in Nigeria, half of the country.
How is it possible to protect women that are victims of rape and sexual abuse if it's in a setting where they're not familiar with?
I think a lot of times, based on the work that we do, based on the women we see, the issues that we deal with are subject to the environment that you live in. For instance, Nigeria is a patriarchal country. So unfortunately, women are already subjugated whether or not they're forced to endure any physical or sexual encounters. We have in Africa and specifically in Nigeria, a lot of traditional practices and cultural norms. And these are, on average, positive things. I mean, we're a rich, wonderful nation. We have, you know, wonderful traditional practices that we're proud of. But sadly, there are some that are harmful to women, and these are still propagated across many communities. We have a lot of women that are encouraged, based on the stigmatization and the social bias, to keep quiet and not speak out when these abuses or instances of abuse occur. And then unfortunately, we have the community that survivor shames, and so doesn't even allow her by giving her an enabling environment to speak out. So when you look at the issue through that lens, with that multifaceted problems that she's dealing with, it's very difficult for her to seek protection, because majority of the time the perpetrator is probably in the home with her, and it's very difficult for her to leave the home to seek assistance, because then the community band together and survivor shame her. And so this is why it's so critical that organizations like ours and other CSOs and NGOs are working in this space to provide the services and a platform for women like that.
It is time for a short break. When we return, we'll have more of my conversation with Dr. Kemi Da Silva Ibru.
Join us, she's in the news moderator Michael Williams and a panel of prominent Washington journalists as they deliberate the latest top stories of the week, including both U.S. President Donald Trump and his Democratic Party opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, hit the campaign trail as Election Day draws nearer. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. If you are just joining us, tonight we are discussing gender-based violence with my guest, Dr. Kemi Da Silva Ibru, founder of the Women at Risk International Foundation in Nigeria. Here is more of our discussion.
So what type of interventions have you implemented that you have found effective?
Well, the organization works under three basic pillars to achieve our overarching ambition and objective of addressing the prevalence of sexual violence and rape and trafficking of young girls and women in Nigeria. We work under the health, education, and community service pillars. So with the health, our intervention is providing a sexual assault referral center or rape crisis center in the epicenter of Lagos State, one of the 36 states of Nigeria. And we also provide satellite services in other states. And with this center, we're able to offer free services with the provision of medical and forensic medical examinations. We're able to offer tests such as HIV and pregnancy tests. We're able to give the post-exposure HIV drugs and the morning after pill if we're fortunate enough to see the survivor in a timely fashion. And then we can start our emotional healing with counseling, whether it's one-on-one counseling or group. And because Nigeria is not strictly a socialist country, we have to explore her social welfare needs as well. Because oftentimes, as we recognize globally, these acts of violence typically occur in safe spaces like her home. And so she needs to be removed from these places of risk. So we need to have the ability to be able to offer her those essential services like shelter and legal aid, and even a vocational skill, because women tend to make poor choices because they're financially constrained. And so we offer all of these services free of charge by absorbing the costs. And we've been open now for 3.5 years, and we're close to 2,000 beneficiaries that we've been able to assist. With our educational pillar, the idea is prevention, going into elementary and tertiary institutions and designing and implementing specific programs to address the needs of the different groups. So with a girl child, for instance, in an elementary school, the focus is on preventing sexual violence, perhaps, and empowering her and giving her the necessary information and knowledge that she needs. With regards to the boy, perhaps he's changing his mindset, because perhaps he already has a mindset of a potential perpetrator, because he's socialized in a home of violence where he doesn't know better. So we target our programs to change his mindset into thinking of becoming a protector of women, as opposed to becoming a perpetrator when he reaches adulthood. And in the tertiary institutions, we're dealing with young adults who now are dealing with the challenges, not just of sexual violence from the home, but also in schools and on campuses. We have situations where we have a sex for grade, quid pro quo scenario with school authorities, so we need to address that. And then, of course, the peer pressure that comes on campus when it comes to campus sexual violence. So we have programs that we design. We have partners such as the EU UN Women Spotlight Initiative working in the tertiary institutions. And we've been able to provide these impactful programs that are actually seeing transformational change in the different target groups. And then finally, the community service was important because many parts of Africa, including Nigeria, is still very much in the rural areas. I mean, Nigeria, 54% of us still live in areas where there's no access to internet services, for instance. And so the infrastructure we have in place in urban centers with our website, for instance, or our 24-hour confidential helpline, these are women and girls that can't access. So we need to take those programs into these rural communities. And there we identify community leaders, we empower them with training, and we then ask them to go back into their communities to raise awareness and assist. A good example is the traditional birth attendant, which is a doula in some parts of Africa, because she provides informal medical care to women and expectant mothers. So we go across different rural communities training these traditional birth attendants as first responders to gender-based violence. We've done over, I think we've trained over almost 1,300 of them now. And so they're able to now impact in their communities because they have the necessary toolkit to be able to do so.
When we look at situations where women are in relationships where they experience the violence, a lot of time people will say, why do they stay in those relationships? What are some of the reasons why women will stay in violent relationships?
Well, in this part of the world, in Africa, specifically in Nigeria, the primary reason is the woman's mindset. Women are socialized from a very young age to be subjugated by men. Sadly, young girls see it with regards to their parents and perhaps their mothers. And mothers encourage young girls because it's culturally acceptable to accept their lot in life when they're in families and, you know, situations of abuse. And as I mentioned earlier, she doesn't have an enabling community that even empowers her to leave. She doesn't have the resources because unfortunately we are dealing with a low middle income country with a lot of challenges, both politically and economically. And so you're dealing with a young woman, perhaps with a young family, in a home of violence, but she doesn't have the necessary support or network to be able to leave the home. And then again, she also has been socialized from such a young age into believing that this is permissible and this is acceptable. And so therefore, she carries on enduring these acts of violence daily.
And you talked about prevention with the young boy in school, and that's such an important part of the whole idea of preventing gender-based violence. When we prevent it from a younger age, what about the adult men?
So I agree with you. I think the more formative age, between that 12 and 16 years of age for boys, is extremely important in terms of changing his narrative. And we can't have a conversation on preventing gender-based violence and not include boys and men. Our focus when it comes to men is actually the police force, the law enforcement officers. We have found in Nigeria that a lot of times police officers don't have the necessary sensitivity training or perhaps even the necessary information on referral and protocols in addressing survivors of rape. And so we embarked on a program where we started to go into different police stations to train these police officers because they are the first point of call when it comes to reporting these cases. And so if they're not equipped with the necessary training, sensitization, and basic understanding of why it is so relevant to address a rape survivor in a particular way, then unfortunately she either does not report the case or she doesn't come back. And more importantly, the alleged perpetrator carries on with impunity. And so this is how we decided that we needed to tackle that aspect through the law enforcement officers.
Sex trafficking, that's such an important topic. I don't know if you want to say something very quick about that, the extent of the problem, why it's important to address it.
Sexual or human trafficking is another huge aspect and another face, if you will, of gender-based violence. I mean, this is an issue that affects one globally. In Africa, specific to Nigeria, we have seen statistics of over 60% of women, perhaps in Libya, for instance, which is a typical transportation or destination country, actually come from Nigeria. So a lot of times what we're dealing with is we're dealing with not just sexual trafficking across state lines in our 36 states in the Federation, but also dealing with it, you know, from one location in Nigeria to outside of Nigeria to other destination countries. And we work alongside a lot of the governmental agencies, such as the ones that work in Nigeria to address the issue. And our primary focus is when these young girls and women return, that they're able to seek the proper counseling and assistance they need to be able to reintegrate back into the communities that they come from.
Okay, Dr. Kemi da Silva, one final word before we wrap.
I think it's really important for us to continue this conversation. I believe violence against women and girls across the world is one of the most pervasive forms of a human rights violation. And like Hillary Clinton said, this is still the unfinished business of the 21st century. And I believe it's time that we finish it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kemi da Silva, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Limpid, again, for having me.
South African Andrew King's tattoo parlor was suffering from the pandemic lockdown and social distancing, so he gathered a team and put their creativity into other fashionable designs to fit the market. King created a shirt with a built-in mask for COVID-19, which could prove a hit in South Africa, the country worst hit by the virus on the continent. Franco Puglisi reports from Johannesburg.
South African tattoo parlor owner Andrew King's business was hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. King explains.
It was devastating, and because the tattoo industry was regarded in the same as the beauty industry, like the hairdressers and such as.
But instead of rolling over in defeat, King put his creative skills to work with clothing designers in an effort to fight COVID-19. Designer Andre Krukamp worked on the shirt that emerged.
The concept, the idea of having a fixed mask really appealed to me. Then, of course, we went back to the drawing board with Andrew, and the thing was to have a product that was actually medically certified.
The result, King's Pure Hair brand shirt, has a filter inserted into the neck that has been independently tested. JP Harmsay is a technical manager for Vivid Air, the company that tested the filter.
We recently tested the D15 mask, and the results we got was very good. But especially on the bigger particles, we had great results, making it very effective against the spread of COVID-19.
The neck of the garment is pulled up over the face and mouth when needed to prevent infected droplets from spreading the virus. But the mask also can be tucked away when not required, says King.
So practicalities is when the mask is up, people can turn their heads up and down side to side. And the convenient side of it is that you can put it down and it's always on you.
The shirt could prove a hit in South Africa, the country on the continent hit hardest by the virus. Kerry Lubscher, who is a customer, gives her a perspective on the mask shirts.
It's good to wear them when you have forgotten your mask and it's easy to pull up, and especially because I work with clients, it's nice and easy to put on, tie it back, make it comfortable, and it's easy breathable and easy to talk through as well.
It's just one of the latest creation as the world adjusts to the reality of COVID-19. Franco Puglisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Botswana is recording a surge in COVID-19 cases just months after the Southern African country was lauded with its efforts to keep the virus at bay. Daily recorded infections have jumped to more than 100 in the past 10 days. Botswana has eased pandemic restrictions, but recently extended a state of emergency meant to fight infections to March next year. From Gaborone, reporter Mkondisi Dube has the details.
Botswana COVID-19 Task Force Deputy Chairperson Professor Mosepile Mosepile says the numbers have risen significantly in recent weeks. The country, with a population of 2 million people, has now recorded more than 3,000 cases from more than 222,000 COVID-19 tests. The number of new daily cases has surged since August.
This marks a significant increase in our cases, where we registered about 20 cases per month back in August. And then beginning in September, in the early part of the month, we were registering 40 cases that crept up to close to 70 and then above 100. Hence why we have an average of about 100 cases per day for the past 10 days, really making a significant change in burden of disease locally.
Botswana lifted lockdown restrictions in May when COVID-19 cases were below 100. Despite easing restrictions, the country remains under a state of emergency, which was recently extended by 6 months to next March. President Mokgweetsi Masisi defended the decision to extend the state of emergency.
It is regrettable that we have of late experienced an exponential rise in local transmissions after the lifting of movement restrictions on the 22nd of May 2020, mainly in the Greater Gaborone Zone. Particularly disturbing is that from July to August 2020, the number of local transmission cases surpassed the number of imported ones.
Schools remain open despite education sector unions calling for their closure to protect students and staff. Many parents like Mpo Marubing say the government should close schools to protect learners.
The virus is now everywhere. The only logical thing is to close the schools. Our children are at risk.
The virus has claimed the lives of 18 residents since March. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Truck drivers carrying commercial cargo are experiencing long delays at the Brett Bridge border post between Zimbabwe and South Africa, tied to restrictions imposed to fight COVID-19. The border is an exit point for truckers carrying commercial goods into neighboring countries. Andy Gondo gives us more.
Commercial trucking operators say that they've been experiencing delays of up to 4 days in clearing cargo across the border at the Brett Bridge border post. The delays began at the start of October when South African authorities imposed new clearance procedures under its COVID-19 restrictions. In addition, South African border authorities temporarily stopped trucks from other countries and then the Southern African Development Community if they lack clearance documents from their home country. The resulting pandemonium led to the easing of the measures, although drivers and cargo must still undergo health screening and physical checks. But the chaos continues. Transporters blame other problems such as staff shortages, a malfunctioning weighbridge, and a cumbersome vehicle inspection process. Mike Fitzmaurice is with the Federation of East and Southern Africa Road Transport Associations, FESATA, which represents national road transport associations in 14 Southern African countries. He says the delays have cost his members millions of rands since October 1st.
Not all agents and transporters have representation after 8 p.m. at night. The potential losses are huge. And for every hour lost at Beitbridge, it costs the industry around 300 rand per truck. Based on the current volumes at Beitbridge of 1,000 trucks per day, it is costing the cross-border transport industry approximately 300,000 per hour.
Joseph Msariri, the chief executive of the Shipping and Freight Forwarders Association of Zimbabwe, confirms that the bottleneck continues at the Beitbridge border post. He says the problem is worsened by drivers seeking to circumvent stringent controls at the Botswana border.
Northbound traffic, trucks are taking about 3 days on the African side and then another day on the Zimbabwean side, which makes a total of 4 days to cross a northbound. And normally that would take about 2 days.
Msariri worries the chaos is creating a potential health hazard because of the crowding that is taking place. Fitzmaurice says there's been little progress by either South African and Zimbabwean port authorities in resolving the delays. Beitbridge border post has become an exit point of choice within the region for trucks within the SADC region since the imposition of lockdown regulations in March. More drivers are traveling through Zimbabwe now to avoid tighter pandemic controls at the Botswana border.
It's not really an option because Botswana do not accept negative COVID-19 certificates from other countries, and they insist on testing every driver that comes through, and then he has to be quarantined until the results are available, and then once the results are available, he's allowed to proceed to the exit border.
And Fitzmaurice acknowledge that drivers have some responsibility for the problem if they do not have complete documentation. Both authorities on both sides of the Beitbridge entry point did not respond to requests for comment. Trucking operators say officials in the 16 SADC governments need to work together to find ways to both fight the pandemic and move cargo to stop the economic bleeding in the region. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
That's it for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guest, Dr. Kemi Da Silva Ibru, founder of the Women at Risk International Foundation, based in Nigeria. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat, and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day
take your pick, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Fali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.